From the Sky News Centre at 5. After Catalonia's parliament declared independence, Spain's Senate has voted to impose direct rule on the region. Barry Weir reports.
The resolution has been approved.
Those against the breakaway move had left the chamber, but the majority of MPs in the Catalan parliament backed the motion, leading to celebrations in the street. But the reply was swift from Madrid, voting to take away Catalonia's powers. Some in Barcelona are worried about what's next.
Police and military forces from Spain will go here.
Madrid could now sack the government in Barcelona and take control of the police.
The House of Commons insists claims any MP has breached a code of conduct will be investigated. A report in the Sun newspaper says some females at Westminster have been sharing claims of sexual harassment and assault on WhatsApp. Labour MP John Mann isn't sure Parliament is set up to deal with these sorts of complaints properly.
And unlike the rest of the public sector, Parliament's exempt from the requirements of the Equality Act, and so is getting away with things which elsewhere would be illegal.
A mentally ill man's been jailed for life for killing a university lecturer in a random attack. 39-year-old Mark Loveridge stabbed Daniel Young in South London in January last year. He'll serve his sentence in Broadmoor Psychiatric Hospital. The government believes North Korea may be to blame for the cyber attack that crippled the NHS in May. A report's found basic measures could have prevented it. US documents reveal UK newspaper The Cambridge News received an anonymous tip-off 25 minutes before President John F. Kennedy was shot. The details are in one of nearly 3,000 previously secret documents. In sport, Sam Burgess is unlikely to play again for England at the Rugby League World Cup until at least the semi-finals if they get there. A knee ligament injury is expected to keep him out. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
At the PRSC space, Jamaica Street, Stovecroft, Bristol.
Only on BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping us review this week's news for next week, Halloween. Is former Bristol Mayor George Ferguson and old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. After the 6 o'clock news, evidence emerges Belgian police were behind a 1994 supermarket massacre that killed 28 innocent shoppers. Yes, proof that it wasn't the Soviet Union doing it, after all, during the Cold War. But our own authorities massacring citizens and trying to blame it on Moscow? More from Martin on that after the 6 o'clock news. And today we hear that North Korea was to blame for the NHS cyber attack earlier this year. Is it really? Or could that possibly be more anti-Kim Jong-un propaganda? And things are looking up for a change. We're told this week to beware the British thought police by a government advisor. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 16. Sunny spells and windy tomorrow. Cloudy, though, on Sunday. Next week, highs of 14 Celsius. Most of the week, sunny spells and windy, too, at times. Next weekend, that's the 4th and 5th of November. Highs around 14 again. Sunshine and showers. Going to get out, do it this weekend, folks. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So I start, as I did last week, by just looking briefly at the red list, which is MPs and councillors serving politicians who don't reply to invitations. One of those is that Bristol's Labour leader and Mayor Marvin Rees. He was due to come on the programme about 6 weeks ago, but pulled out at the last minute after I phoned just to confirm he was still coming. Also, Kerry McCarthy, Labour from Bristol East, doesn't get back to phone calls, emails, anything like that. We've also heard, though, and I call it the blue list, which is Jack Lopresti, that's the Tory MP for Filton and Bradley Stoke, and also Chris Skidmore, he's the Tory MP for Kingswood. They've just said simply that they're too busy, that they can't come. At least I get a reply from them. The gold stars go to Bristol's North West Labour MP Darren Jones, Labour MP for Bristol South Karen Smith, and Thangham Debonair Labour MP for Bristol West will be on in the new year. So, helping us review this week's news is former Bristol Mayor George Ferguson. Hi, George. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony. It's like old times.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
And my first question to you is, what are you up to these days?
I'm up to all sorts of things. I'm able to accept invitations that I wasn't able to accept when I was mayor. And what's remarkable is the attention that Bristol has had around the world. I'm off to China tomorrow, Japan after that. I'm all on the same trip, not going via North Korea. I've just come back from the States. These are speaking engagements, and there's a lot of interest in what happened to Bristol. I think it's one of those things that people see from afar better things than they sometimes see near.
A veritable and Tony Blair, then.
I wish I were getting his fees, but it's enough. It pays my way, and I think you learn from travel. The only thing is I feel a little bit guilty about the amount of flying that I've had to do. So next year, I'm resolving that it's European year.
Okay.
And by train.
What about Marvin's non-appearance on here? Because it was difficult. I mean, he came on just for the hustings before, and you were there, actually, for that program.
That's right, yeah.
Ever since then, it's, I mean, we're talking about coming on for 18 months or something since then, just not wanting to appear on the radio. Do you think it's wise?
I don't know. I mean, as you know, it's a full-on job being mayor, so it's difficult to know what the reasons are that he wasn't able to come at any particular time. But I see while you don't give people always an easy time. I think access is really important. Accessibility. I love walking around the city. I love cycling around the city. By the way, I love it even more now that I'm not mayor and people stop me and say, I wish you were back, which is really nice of them. But I think access via media and local media and community radio and things like that is a really important part of the job.
I wonder whether it's...
I suspect it's the people advise him rather than Marvin.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah. I think because he's got a party around him and they're saying, well, we've got nothing to gain, Marvin, from you going on this radio show.
You might get some awkward questions.
Yeah, only the potential that you might get into trouble. So let's just not do it. But at least it would be nice to have a reply saying, no, Marvin doesn't want to do the program.
But, I mean, I had the huge advantage not having a party, not having to be too careful, not having to worry about the next election all the time, because I think that is the problem with our local politics. It's become like national politics. It becomes about the politics. It's about thinking about the next election, and it's the people who are tapping on your shoulder all the time, telling you what to
do. All the time about being part of the city establishment party, the merchants,
I did get a bit of that, especially from you. I did resign from the merchants and kept my decent distance, but if you're doing that job, it's actually quite helpful to have been involved in all sorts. I've been involved in community stuff, adventure playgrounds, loads of things where you could say I had an interest, but they were an interest in Bristol in a very broad sense.
So, I mean, have they invited you back, the merchants?
No. And I think they know that I wouldn't come back. And they're looking for younger people than me.
What do you make of Marvin on the anti-slavery day not this Wednesday, just gone, the Wednesday before, when he gave his State of the City speech, which, by the way, I must correct, because we had two different views on last week's show. One that you'd started this State of the City address, George, and another that Marvin had. It actually was you, wasn't it? That you didn't. Well, you were the first person to do this.
I mean, yes. I mean, I think that Marvin's achieved stuff. He's produced his list of 100 achievements, which include a few things I did. But that is the way of the world, isn't it? That people are always going to take credit for what happens
up here. Surely, it looks like PR. Here are my wonderful achievements. This is the sort of thing you'd expect a business to have in their annual report.
A little bit. Yeah, a little bit. But I was there at his address. I mean, I was partly there out of defence in case he started accusing me of everything. I mean, there was a bit of that, but I, you know, I assumed that would happen. You know, that you take the praise for everything that goes well, and you blame the previous people for everything that goes wrong.
Well, there are a few comments on this show and elsewhere about Marvin's not really being interested in the slavery memorial, something that particularly people from the Afro-Caribbean community were hoping that would happen. I mean, they've got obviously quite a lot in Liverpool about slavery, and not here, really.
Yeah, do you know, years ago, I tried to start with some other people a museum of slavery and civil liberties in Bristol, because I saw that as one of the most important cultural issues, historic and cultural issues in the city. This was many years ago, and it was at the time when the Empire Museum was starting, and they claimed they were going to do that. And basically, through the local establishment, they squashed my efforts to start. I haven't really reminded people of that for years. I think it's a vitally important issue. I would never say that Marvin wasn't interested in that. He, you know, I think that if you look at what Marvin has to say, that the black history issues are really important to him, and understandably so. But I think they should be important to the whole of the city. I think Black History Month is really important, but it's not just important during that month. I think it's also important in helping people realise throughout the year that we shouldn't forget those things.
So what were you planning when you were talking about this, and when was that?
Oh, gosh, probably in the 1980s or early 90s. Probably 1980s, actually. I can't remember when the Empire Museum was started, but it was coincidentally around that time. And I was deliberately thinking of it as the Museum of Slavery and Civil Liberties, so that it had, it wasn't just grinding over the old historic issues, however important they are. It was about modern-day slavery. It was about the civil liberties issues that are very alive today in the UK.
Have you spoken to Marvin about that?
No, I haven't. No.
Yeah, because I think you should, and you'd certainly get support from us here. You know, we can advertise things for you if you want, because it's the sort of thing, I think, that having been to Liverpool and seen the effort, I mean, it's a pretty puny effort, really, in the M Shed, which is just, it doesn't even mention the merchants, and it's not really, it doesn't compare to what's really, I think, it deserves, because these are issues which mustn't be forgotten about, really. So
absolutely, yeah. But I wouldn't, I mean, you know, I always find these quite difficult. What I think is important is to keep the history alive. You know, all that, the discussion about the naming of the Colson Hall and everything like that. I'm all for the, I'm all for that discussion. I'm all for finding a new appropriate name, but I'm not for getting rid of the name until we find a new appropriate name. I'm not for taking statues down. I think they should be a reminder
about the Stevenson
good
Hall?
And
isn't that,
bad.
Isn't that the obvious? The one of the abolitionists? William Stevenson.
Yeah, but the Colson Hall isn't about... we've got to think about the Colson Hall. Is it? It's not about slavery or anti-slavery. It's not about black issues. I think we need to have a name that the whole of Bristol can buy into. And maybe it is a name that comes from... You know, I don't think it should be commercial, but but nevertheless, there may be a name that helps attract more funding for the Colson Hall.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. There was we've had some famous Bristolians, haven't we? Was it Edmund Burke? Is another one who was quite a civil libertarian. I don't know if you're a fan of his, George.
Edmund Burke said some great things.
Well, they've got his statue in the centre, quite near the Colston statue, and of course it says on the bottom.
Is he staring him in the face?
No, they're actually both staring out to sea.
Oh right, okay,
aren't they? But he says on the bottom is, "I want to be a member of Parliament to have my share in doing good and resisting evil." Which wasn't his most famous statement, but still quite a useful contribution. And of course, he because he was opposed to the slave trade, the merchant venturers and others who were the electorates at the time got rid of him because they were furious with him. Said, "Well, you can't go and oppose the main industry of this city." And he then gave the classic defence of representative democracy,
absolutely,
which
brilliant.
Is, "You voted for me because I'm a jolly good fellow, or that's what you said I was, and this is my view, and that's what you're going to get, whether you like it or not." And there's a case to be made for that. And of course, the electorate in the day was very very narrow. So he wasn't representing their views.
It was all male, and it was based on beer and bribery.
Well, but mostly it was based on property qualifications.
Yeah, that's right. But no, I thought that his letter to the electors of Bristol was one of the most brilliant political letters ever, and actually is a great argument for why we shouldn't be running a country on referenda.
Oh, okay. Well, there's a whole other subject there. But before we get off, Colston,
there's a can of worms for you.
What about? Isn't there another Burke quote, which is to do with evil will triumph if good men do nothing?
Absolutely.
Which is
that's
right.
Yeah, that's his most famous quote. Yeah.
That should drive us all.
So yeah, okay.
Good
come
men
on.
Like you, Tony.
Oh well, Edmund Burke Hall. That sounds quite nice, doesn't it? I mean, also, I think he wasn't. What were his politics?
Well, he was a Whig. That meant he was on the radical side of politics, but he then disappointed his radical friends like Charles James Fox, who they both opposed the American the attempts to crush American independence. But he took a very hard line against the French Revolution, and he fell out with Fox over that. And many would say that Burke had a better, Burke Payne and Fox were very strong supporters of the French Revolution, and that's the point at which Burke turned to the right and became, the ancestor of the modern Conservative Party, in fact.
Wasn't he just booted out, basically?
Well, they
manoeuvred out.
Parties in those days were very much sort of congeries of like-minded people who fell out over dinner or whatever. There wasn't really much of a structure.
George, what are your thoughts on Brexit then? Because that's what you were hinting at there.
I'm very sad about it. What's happening, because I think Brexit is now dominating the whole political debate. It's dominating our economics. It's dominating the media. I think that it's made life really difficult for some people, especially immigrants. I think it's one of the craziest things that this country's ever done. And it's actually, it was a close-ish vote. In real terms, I think a decision of that weight should be made with a greater majority rather than such a narrow majority. But we've got to make the best of where we are. I'm hoping that that parliamentary democracy comes into play and that there is a vote on the final deal. But the government are showing no appetite for that. Although I don't like referenda, even a referendum on the final deal.
Hang on, you don't like referendum, but you want one.
Well, that's why I'm saying I'm a bit split on it. We had a referendum. I think the only way of undoing a referendum is to have another one. But I think we've jumped at those too easily. I mean, the thing about representative democracy is you elect people to take judgments, considered, educated judgments, whether you feel those people are right for it or not, while a referendum tends to be a knee-jerk reaction based on inaccurate information.
So you don't think people knew what they were voting for?
I think a lot of people didn't appreciate all the issues involved. I'm not saying they were wrong. I'm just saying that I think there is a hell of a, I think when you've got weighty issues like that and lies are being told, as lies were being told on both sides, I think that it becomes really difficult to people to know how to vote. And I met people on the last day who didn't know how they were going to vote, but they still voted. So it is, Bristol was strongly in favour of remaining, and I was misled by that, thinking that Remainers would win.
Well, the polls were all wrong, weren't they, on Trump as well? So, but also today we've had this news that Catalonia has declared UDI about half an hour, 45 minutes ago. There's a similar sentiment over in Catalonia. They actually want to remain part of the European Union, but they do want to separate from Madrid.
Well, like Scotland would want to remain part of the European Union if it separated from the United Kingdom. And
No? The European Union is saying, no, you have to leave the European Union, Catalonia.
Well, I think that's just solidarity with the fourth largest economy in Europe, which is Spain. And I think it is, isn't it, Martin?
I don't know, it's the fourth.
Yeah, I think it comes after France, Germany and ourselves. And so I think it is not in that order. I think they see it as destabilising. That's the that's the issue with Europe. But in a way, this is Spain's Brexit.
But isn't it destabilising sending the police and the army into Catalonia?
I think it was a very heavy-handed overreaction that has caused people to dig their heels in and has got us got them where they are. I mean, I know quite a few Catalonians, and is that what you call them?
Catalans.
Yeah, I know quite a few Catalans, and they feel mixed about it because they feel passionate about being Catalan, but actually they have enjoyed huge benefits of being part of a nation.
I mean, it wasn't like the knife-edge Brexit vote, was it? 90% in favour of
yes.
And I mean, of course, because of course, people were looking at the reaction that Madrid.
It was an unofficial election, and I suspect that it wouldn't be 90% if you had an official election, because there were a lot of people who didn't vote just out of objecting to the fact that it was a Catalan decision rather than an official decision.
Do you have faith in the constitutional court in Spain? I mean, because there are people who are pointing at it now and saying that actually this is looking back to the Franco days, the People's Party was Franco's party.
Well, funnily enough, my dad, who was in the military, was in, and I, as a small child, lived in Gibraltar during Franco times. So it was terrifying. Actually, it was not that long after the Spanish Civil War, and there were dead tanks and things all over the countryside. So any idea of replicating some of the Franco policy is a bit scary.
Martin, you mentioned Paul Preston's book, The Spanish Holocaust, last week in the second hour. But actually, Franco had a pretty horrific policy, didn't he, of deliberately slowing things down, going town to town. And there are mass graves still, hundreds of thousands of people buried in Spain.
Well, when Peter Preston, who's a British academic, wrote the book...
It's Paul Preston.
Paul Preston, sorry. He was questioned by other academics, can you use the word Holocaust here? Are you misusing the word? And he said no, because there's a lot of research gone into the book. He said, I think this is an absolutely legitimate word to use, because when Franco came to power, he didn't stop killing. He carried on killing for several decades afterwards. And the whole of the country is full of mass graves caused by the regime. And Baltasar Garzón, the radical judge in Spain who sent Inigo to prison, even though he was a government minister, for running death squads in the Basque region. He used to send Eta to prison as well, of course. He was even-handed. He wanted to have a sort of truth and reconciliation approach, because we should dig up all of these bodies, we should find everybody's grandparents, they should be given proper burials, and we should not necessarily prosecute, but there should be, you know, a reconciliation process where all this will have to come out. And, of course, there's lots of opposition to that, particularly from the People's Party, because, of course, they will be in the firing line if that goes ahead. And then Baltasar Garzón was basically pushed out of the judiciary by the PP establishment.
What I remember most as a child in Spain was the grinding poverty, you know. Kids with no shoes, no proper clothes, living outside, children living in cardboard boxes. The strange thing is, it's the sort of poverty we now see on our streets today amongst some of the rough sleepers.
Martin, what are your thoughts about what's going to happen now? Because we've now, I mean, today, literally, we've had this denouement. They've declared UTI, and the Spanish leader, Mariano Rajoy, is immediately tweeting to say the rule of law will be restored. That's the way he puts it.
Well, what does independence mean in the modern world? You can declare independence, but the train timetable will remain the same. The bins will have to be collected or not. It doesn't mean much, one way or the other. I mean, you have to give some concrete flesh onto the bones of independence.
Let me tell you what
it means. You have to negotiate. Both sides will have to negotiate.
Martin, one of the big things it does mean is that Catalonia is responsible for the collection and spending of its own taxes.
Yes, but at the same time, the national debt of Spain will remain the national debt of Spain. When Slovenia split from Yugoslavia, there was one of the things that we're all arguing about is who's going to pay for the national debt. And the Slovenians thought that the Kosovans at the other end of the country, they're the ones we've run up the national debt for to pay for transfer payments to them. We're a successful European country. We could just hop out of Yugoslavia and into the European Union, which is effectively what they did. But of course, by doing that and being recognised by the Western powers for doing that, they set in train a motion, you know, an uncontrollable situation. Of course, the Spanish government still doesn't recognise the independence of Kosovo. Precisely for that reason, because they can see the precedents that are involved in recognising independence. And the Catalonians have got to recognise that your independence bid, however justified you may feel it to be, is going to have to be looked at in the context of other independence movements in Italy, India, and so on. So, well, we've nothing to do with India. That's not how the Indians see it. Yeah. So there tends to be, you know, there are rules about this, and those rules are there for a reason, because each time somebody declares independence like this, like Biafra or anywhere else, it sets precedence for other people, which is why everybody's got an interest in it, and an interest in it being resolved peacefully. If it is resolved peacefully and everybody can live with the result, that will be a result for the Catalonia and a result for everybody.
George, one of the I wonder if this is the sort of thing, because you've been to this, the Parliament of Mayors thing, where you meet mayors from all over the world. Is this the sort of thing that you might have been talking about there? But I was wondering, because I was reading an article yesterday on the SACA website. Now, he's a former UN military analyst who talks about he was kicked out of the UN because he was telling people things they didn't want to hear. And one of the things he was saying is that the misjudgment by Juncker and the European Union over what they've been doing in Spain could spell the end for the European Union, because what they've done is they've backed effectively a authoritarian approach by the Spanish government against the European Charter on Human and Fundamental Rights, which includes things like allowing freedom of speech, where they've taken over now, or imagine today they will be attempting to take over the TV and radio stations, and also of course with the violence that we saw, the police against people who were trying to vote in the referendum.
Well, I think it is going to be a real test for Europe, and yes, I think there have been some serious misjudgments, both by the Spanish government and by the European leadership.
Do you want to say where you think we might be in a week's time, both of you? George?
I think we'll be seeing huge demonstrations. We might see some violence. I hope not, because I think Barcelona, which is the capital of Catalonia, is a wonderful, wonderful city, and a lot of us have enjoyed being there. But I think it's going to be a really difficult standoff. I mean, the guy who is the... who's now president of Catalonia, is, you know, he's absolutely dedicated to this mission of independence. So I don't think he's going to back off. And I think the reaction of the Spanish government is going to become tougher rather than gentler.
His name is Charles Puigdemont.
He's Charles Puigdemont.
Martin, what do you? Where's Charles going to be? Is he going to be in jail this time next
week? Well, I think we saw this in the Baltic states in the 90s. Effectively, you can't impose your will on people if they don't want it. It's just not possible. On the other hand, you can't actually walk away and say we're independent when you haven't sorted out, for example, who's going to pay the national debt. That was the thing that really smashed Yugoslavia, because everybody's discussing who's going to pay the national debt. And of course, even if you split, somebody has to agree, you know, the creditors are going to say that you're going to take a certain proportion of the debt and you're going to take a certain proportion of it. Of course, maybe they shouldn't have been in debt. That was one of the problems in Yugoslavia.
Could you not just renege on the debt and say, well, sorry, we're not paying it?
You can, and that's what if you're asking me what will happen with this kind of political gamesmanship going on, the potential is for countries to default on their debts because they can't pay them, even if they wanted to. At that point, the banking system comes under fire. And if we've been discussing all of this, what is sort of cultural stuff, Brexit, Catalonia, all the rest of it, and we've forgotten we should have been focusing on the banking system. The financial system is absolutely dysfunctional. And of course, there's a vested interest at the top of the tree in that system to pretend that it isn't. They're now, of course, all over the world talking about raising interest rates, but they don't know if they dare. because if just a small rise in interest rates might be enough to tip it over. And of course, the fear of this, you know, is going to lead to a potential runs on Spanish banks, etc. All of which
Martin,
will spread quickly.
Is this your very own project fear?
No, I'm just pointing out that this is the danger of this situation. No doubt they will carry on ramming about what the independence means forever, just as we're still ramming about what the Northern Irish peace deal means years after it was all signed. The problem is that with the fragility of the financial system, any one of these, you know, crises, you know, could tip it over, and that most people have just forgotten all about that.
Do you share Martin's worries about the economic side of things, George, or do you not think it's something mayors need to be really too concerned about?
Well, as a mayor, you are reliant on a healthy economy in general, but it's not something I'd regard myself as an expert about. But I don't think we've got rid of any of the fundamental problems that led to the 2007-2008 crash.
Bailout.
I'm pretty sure that most of the issues still remain, and there are events could tip it over again.
What about let's bring things down to earth a little bit, back down to ground zero here in Bristol. And there's been an immense number of swaps around in chief executives, haven't there? The latest, I think her name was Anna, who's just gone, and with a £70,000 payoff leaked through private eye. I mean, the big question, we were here with Jeff Gollop from the Conservatives and Gary Hopkins, the Lib Dem leader, last week, both of whom were rather shocked that she'd been paid off at all, having voluntarily left.
Well, I didn't think she had voluntarily left, and I think this probably says she didn't. And I am genuinely concerned at the loss of expertise at the top of the council now in terms of the officers. And I put together a new structure, not all new officers, but a new structure that was a very simple one that had chief executive, four senior directors. We all worked in the same office. We knew what each other were doing. It wasn't political. And I feel now it's all being politically driven, I think principally by Kevin Slocum, who is the who was the one person that Marvin brought into his administration with a political title, we've lost, I don't know, like probably 15 out of 20 of the senior officers now. Well, you can't. Memory is important. An element of continuity is really important. So this costs not just the salaries. Don't just think about the salaries. Think about the real costs of the disruption. That's what concerns me most. And the devotion that a lot of those people had. I mean, Anna was new and temporary. I never met her.
Well, she wasn't supposed to be temporary.
Well, no, but yeah, no.
It turned out that way.
Yeah.
Martin, what do you make of this?
I listen week after week to this developing story.
Okay, what I'm getting from it is that another complete reorganisation. I mean, this is actually far more disruptive maybe swapping a few roles around. It seems there's a lot of disruption going on, which is not what you need when the city's effectively in crisis with libraries under threat, all these sorts of things. I mean, you must look at this, George, and think, well, I managed to keep most of the libraries, all the libraries pretty much open. And now people, there's a massive mismatch, isn't there, what people voted for.
Yeah.
People voted for a Labour mayor who would look after those basic public services, and what they've got is almost the opposite.
Well, there is an irony in that lots of the councillors, particularly the Labour group, would come down on me like a ton of bricks if I even threatened one library or any cut at all, some of which were cuts to budget but not necessarily to services. But whatever cut, I would get a heap of trouble, you know. Now, I didn't cut enough, and so everything that they do is now to it's now my fault.
But can you see why people get disillusioned with voting?
About that.
When they seem to be voting for a more radical, more public services, and actually what they get is, oh my goodness, it's totally the opposite.
I was a strong defender of public services, and I was advised to close 7 libraries. I decided that the only library I would close was a single library, and that actually was proposed to be replaced. There are ways of doing things. I think the problem now is it's become all about the cuts. I believe very strongly that you need to invest to save. You need to invest to make a more secure local economy. And that was what drove me most. And I think it's a shame now that the whole agenda is about the cuts. And to be honest, while you'd get the impression that they're in a worse financial position than I inherited, they certainly aren't. I had to cut a hell of a lot out of the budget.
Can I just say, Tony?
Yeah.
What worried me most about the clip you had from Marvin last week was he was using these phrases and saying, we've got to reimagine the council as no longer as a provider, but as an enabler. Now, that sounds a kind of... Yeah, we've got to work within the situation.
Gary was talking about it as this transatlantic management gobbledygook.
Yeah, but I think there's a fundamental political point there. Even if we have to carry out cuts, we should be screaming blue murder about it, because the council shouldn't, in fact, be shrunk in these circumstances. It doesn't make any sense. And he's not just making a virtue out of necessity by using that kind of language. He's normalising the situation that there will be a skeletal council which will function. And, of course, that's probably what we're going to end up with. That's not what we want. That's not what the people of Bristol want, but we're probably going to end up with it. But he shouldn't be using that managerial language to make it seem as if it's all right when it isn't.
My biggest worry is centralising everything. And, you know, I think this is what the parties tend to do, is that they tend to like central control. And that is what we're getting. We're losing the neighbourhood partnerships. We're losing the community hubs that are libraries. And, you know, those neighbourhood community services actually are worth so much more than what they cost. They are the closest contact people have with their council. And I think councillors themselves should be spending more time on their wards, their neighbourhoods, rather than grandstanding in City Hall, which I think has become a sort of local parliament. And I don't think that's what they're elected to do. I think they're elected to represent their local area and bat really hard for their local area to the mayor to make sure that the facilities that they that are prioritised get his attention.
Does Marvin ever call you up and say, George, I'm a little bit bothered about this. I mean, you managed to keep it. I'm having trouble. Any ideas?
No, Marvin and I have a pretty friendly relationship. We don't communicate a lot with each other, but you know, we have each other's phone number and occasionally use it. But I'm only there. But I've said to Marvin, I'm not here to criticise. I don't think that's helpful. I might sometimes get a bit frustrated about things, especially when I'm blamed. So I reserve the right to fight back. But I want to see Marvin. I want to see the city succeed. I always say that, actually, and I said it when I was mayor, that, you know, Bristol will succeed in spite of its leadership, because there are so many good enterprising people in Bristol who do interesting things and social enterprise and everything else. But, you know, it does matter that there is somebody there driving things through. I think, to me, progress is about making things happen. Progress isn't about a load of rhetoric.
The question is it Marvin that's doing it? Because it does seem as if he's got all these advisors around him. He's got people pushing him this way and that way.
Yeah.
You know, he's doing his speech last week where he's looking from side to side, reading from an auto cue, trying to look as if he's in charge. Well, it does look as if other people are writing his script for him.
I was probably an officer's nightmare, because I would do my own thing. And nevertheless, I respected the officers. I think there are a lot of good people there. But in the end, I would make my own judgment. And I I expect Marvin does that, but it is true that he has a much bigger band of political advisors than I had one, and she wasn't even a politician.
I mean, it does make you think. Maybe yeah. it's back to rule by committee again, actually.
Well, I think it is, and it's and rule by review to a certain extent. I think this this thing of reviewing everything, you know, it's always good to make sure you're doing the right thing, but the danger is you actually spend so much time reviewing things that that nothing is seen to really happen.
Anyway, so, okay, rule by committee, Marvin. Come on this radio show and tell us it's not happening. So let's have a listen to Marvin now from his State of the City speech last week. And here he's talking about young people and education.
I thank my Cabinet Lead for Education and Skills and, incidentally, my favourite Conservative, Claire Hiscott, for her leadership and the many schools and education partners who contributed. And as they did in Project Rainbow, helping young people with special educational needs to live independently. Again, collaboration with City of Bristol College, parents and the young people themselves. The Boys Club's project has been established to address underachievement of early age boys. The Bristol Scholar Programme with the university has been initiated. 42 scholars started at the university. Three quarters of those students became the first in their family to go to university. Our Works Programme has been rolled out. The programme brings together employers, learning providers and communities and will deliver over 1,000 meaningful work experiences in the next year, especially for people from low-income households. Contributors include EDF, Bristol Green Capital Partnership, The Bottle Yard and Geneco. The Excellence in Schools Group will be submitting joint bids for the £140 million Strategic School Improvement Fund to support schools most in need to improve school performance and pupil attainment. We're aiming to boost the number of chess clubs at schools so that every child has the opportunity to learn to play. And at City Hall, just a few months ago, we hosted our very own chess tournament for primary schools. We have facilitated £154,000 of grant funding to 28 community-led projects for clean energy initiatives, and we actively promoted the Sugar Smart campaign. We had our first Exceptional People in Care Awards, and we're grateful to the city partners and organisations who sponsored. The awards showed our appreciation for amazing achievements and encouraged them in their journey towards a successful life after care. We've refreshed our corporate parenting strategy, committing the council as a caring and ambitious corporate parent to children in care. And we continue to provide social care to our most vulnerable adult citizens. The Care Act of 2014 brought additional responsibilities for local authorities, but we have found new ways of making a difference, as well as increasing our social care budgets by over £17 million. And I thank my Cabinet Lead for Adults, Helen Holland, who has taken over this incredibly challenging portfolio.
That's Marvin speaking last week. One of the things he's having a few problems with the auto cue there, reading things out slightly wrong, but one of the things he didn't really talk about was the problems with some of these schools in the city, which are academy schools. Kingfisher Academy, for example, is run by the Merchant Venturers. It's just got an inadequate score, no mention of that. The Merchant Venturer run City Academy, where we used to do this show from, was taken to court and found guilty of institutional racism. Chief executive of Colston Girls' School as well was in court last week for indecent assault against a 16-year-old girl. So this whole academy system, George, is not... I mean, we're also hearing there about sponsorship of education through big companies like EDF. I mean, is this the way we should go?
I was always sorry that local authorities lost the plot on education, and I think it means that schools are not now under the proper leadership of local authorities, or most of them aren't, because of the academy system. That combined with the private-public partnerships that funded these academies, I think has left us in a very difficult left us with some difficult issues, especially one of continuing costs that we can't get rid of. A failure of local authorities being able to adapt what happens to the schools, because they are now under a public-private partnership that is a contract for 20 or 30 years. So I think there's some real issues with that. And I objected when I was president of the RIBA, I was objecting to that system. But I listened to that list with some amusement. Apart from the bringing chess into the schools, which I think is a really good thing, and I know it's a passion of Marvin's, I think every single one of those things was either initiated or encouraged by me.
Martin, what do you make of that, particularly the problems that there have been with some of these academies, and the Kingfishers particularly, and also the idea of, well, we're going to have sponsored education now?
Well, you've got to remember that the academies aren't, the local authority isn't responsible for the academies. That's why he hasn't mentioned them. They should be,
yeah, that's right.
but he hasn't mentioned them because they're not. I think there are two fundamental problems. He's trying to make the best of a bad situation. And what I'd like to hear more about is, why is the spending assessment for local authorities wrong? The resources should be there to be more ambitious. And the other thing is, of course, I don't really believe in council tax. In Northern Ireland, they still have the rating system. The rates were not abolished in Northern Ireland during the poll tax era. They didn't dare. And that means that local authorities in Northern Ireland are better funded. And eventually we may have to reinvent the wheel and bring back a land-based tax or a property-based tax to fund local government in the main part of the UK. And I think probably, suppose from my point of view, I'm not really interested in nitty-gritty details, and that's probably why I'm not a councillor or a mayor or whatever.
But we are the most centrally funded country in Europe, aren't we?
That's right. But the problem with having just a rates-based system is places like Bristol will do really well out of that, but places like South Wales wouldn't.
So you've got to have some
compensation. Yeah. Although it's not fair.
Okay. Yeah. On top of all this, we've heard this week, Marvellous Marvin has announced Bristol City Council will be putting forward another £25 million worth of cuts in the Bristol Post. That's on top of the £33 million saved this year. So when you say you're talking about all that seems to be happening is more and more cuts under Marvin, that seems to be absolutely right. Almost double what we thought we were going to have
to
deal with.
Yeah, there are a few distractions, like the proposal for a new underground, you know, that seem to be just out of this world as far as I'm concerned, and I think we should be thinking about the things we can do rather than
sort of proposal I don't think's come from Marvin. It's someone who's come along, we've got a great idea, Marvin, yeah, here's something you can stick in your portfolio here, look, talk about this. And they talked about HS2, they talked about Hinckley C.
Things that we're not building first. You know, what about the line to Portishead? You know, before we start thinking about an underground, there are certain things that are ready. You know, they've been planned for ages. Let's just get a move on. Those infrastructure projects are important. I mean, as you know, I'm for getting more people out of their cars. I'm all for investment in public transport. But I think we should, you know, we've got enough in the list to deal with. Let's just do it.
Martin, what do you make of the announcement this week? Another £25 million worth of cuts this year on top of the £33 million.
Well, I think people have got to recognise that this is simply wrong. We shouldn't be doing this. The government itself has now... I mean, I was thinking about this earlier when I was driving. Did I mention driving? I was thinking while I was driving about the fact that there's been tax cuts for wealthier people in this country. Now, the central government, the Conservative government, how can you justify cutting anything while you're making tax cuts for your wealthy friends? And I think that the whole narrative around austerity has simply collapsed. They can't push it anymore. People were prepared to swallow it for a while on the grounds that if it hurts, it must be doing
us
some
September,
good.
But in September, Marvin had a rally, didn't he?
Yes.
Against his own cuts. Yeah. And now he's just done the opposite. He's actually increasing the number of cuts.
But I mean, as you know,
There's something surreal
about it, and I would prefer him to be taking a more robust line. And what we really need to be doing is saying we need to change the central government. I don't really believe things can be changed that much at Bristol level. And I'm sure you wouldn't agree with me, George, because that was your passion. But I see you've got to get the national strategy right.
Yeah,
and if you've got the national strategy right, then you can start tweaking at local level.
We're getting a slight fudge of devolution. Devolution has been on the agenda. I did the you know, I led on the deal with the government on the metro, the metro region devolution, which has brought some more central government funding. But fundamentally, we're not getting fiscal devolution at all. We're getting devolution in name. It's got to come with some proper funding. It's got to come with our own taxation staying locally instead of 97% of it going to the central government, and then we have to get on bended knee to do anything.
What? Why is it, do you think, that Marvin's going ahead with this whole library closure thing, it looks like, even though there's all sorts of other plans that have been put forward to him? For example, setting up a charity to run the libraries, this kind of thing, things that have worked elsewhere. Marvin seems dead set against that.
Well, it seemed, where it came from. I mean, it seemed to come from the temporary chief executive, I think, this really savage cuts program. And so he's obviously been persuaded that there is no alternative. But I'm a strong believer in finding creative alternatives to these things. And there is a passion about libraries. Now, it is true only about 15% of people technically use each library. But I think people, their local library. But I do think that there is, that there's a much deeper story to that. And that it is some people's only access to the means to sit down and think about getting a job and use a computer and reading. As I think there's quite a return to books as well, and I think a lot of people are fed up with having to read off the screen.
You know what, one of the things is with the internet has brought with websites like bookfinder.com, any book that you've tried to get over the years and then forgotten about, just dredge your mind back. Oh, there's that book I wanted to read. You can now go online and usually snap it up for a song very easily using those sites. So I still love my actual physical paper books. I scribble in them, all that sort of thing. And that's been, I think, one of the things we can't surely go away to this complete paperless world.
Yeah, I think it'll be finding people setting up sort of secondhand bookshops come libraries. I'm thinking about it. If they take away my local library, we'll step in and do something in the community.
Well,
and
it's okay if you've got them cash to do it.
But absolutely,
of course,
the
areas that are going to suffer the most are where people just could never afford to.
And you're dead right. And that's why it's vitally important that these things are done through the local authority that are representative of all the people of all the city.
Come on, Marvin, pull your socks up. So we'll have a listen now to Prime Minister's questions and this whole issue of low pay, because there's so many hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people who are going to work every day and simply hardly getting enough money to make ends meet.
Jeremy Corbyn!
Mr. Speaker, the government's own Social Mobility Commission reported that low pay was endemic in the United Kingdom. Right. One in four workers permanently stuck in low-paid jobs. That's why Labour backs a real living wage of £10 per hour to make work pay.
Right.
Mr. Speaker, this government doesn't really know whether it's coming or going. They say... Mr. Speaker, the Conservative Party and the government says they have full confidence in universal credit, but won't vote for it. They say they will end the NHS pay cut, but won't allocate any money to pay for it. The Community Secretary backs £50 billion of borrowing on housing, but the Chancellor says it's not policy. The Brexit Secretary says they're planning for a no-deal Brexit. The Chancellor says they're not. Isn't the case, Mr. Speaker? This government is weak, incompetent, divided, and unable to take a decision.
Order!
Isn't it the case that this government is weak, incompetent and divided and unable to take the essential decisions necessary for the good of the people of this country?
Now, I, w- will tell the right honourable gentleman, of course we want to see people earning higher wages. Of course we want, as we are doing, to be able to ensure we can invest in our public services. But the way to do that, the way to have a higher standard of living, to have higher wages, to invest in our public services, to have a better future for our for people in this country, is to build and continue to build that stronger economy. And you don't build a stronger economy by losing control of public finances. You don't build a stronger economy by uncontrolled borrowing. You don't build a stronger economy by hitting people with the highest taxes in our peacetime history. You don't build a stronger economy by voting against progress in our Brexit negotiations. Stronger economy by planning for capital flight and a run on the pound. That's what Labour would do, and we will never let it happen.
Well, this whole rhetoric about the stronger economy and the competence of the Conservative government, they've not been able to bring down the deficit in the timescales that they've said, and that's because you can't, in fact, bring the deficit, which anybody who knew anything about it knew they would never be able to do it. So we're still just stumbling along, pretending to bring the deficit down, and people have seen through it. They've realised that you can't go on for year after year cutting the bone of the infrastructure that you're going to require if you're going to have a viable economy. And I think they've lost the competence argument. That's what's beginning to happen. People have just seen through it. And I think the other thing that she mentioned there, run on the pound, what is quite likely to happen if Brexit turns into a car crash, as it seems to be, is that the speculators will have a run on the pound. And at that point, they will have to raise interest rates to protect the currency. The property market will collapse, and then we'll have a general election and we'll see who should be running the country.
George, what do you make of the Prime Minister's reaction there? I mean, are they competent to run the economy? Corbyn's really saying that they should just get out of the way.
Well, I think they've shown themselves to be less than competent, I think is the politest way of putting it. But it may surprise you that I think we need huge structural change, that whatever governments do, we've now got global corporations that are more powerful than governments. And I think there is only a certain amount of adjusting that governments are able to do. I think we'll have a much healthier nation if we support local businesses, if we support the smaller businesses, rather than spending all our money in these huge global corporate food shops, clothes shops, and what have you. So
they're the ones who avoid tax, aren't they? So they're the ones who are succeeding. It's
absolutely
almost like a race to the bottom.
And it is. But I think the power lies with us as the consumers to do something about it. It is the only power we have, is our spending power, and we should use it wisely.
Finally,
and I remind myself of that every day.
Finally, there was just this rather, I found quite shocking, with Theresa May saying how proud she was of the Balfour Declaration. It's 100 years since that and the creation of the State of Israel. What are your thoughts on that? Are you proud of 100 years since Balfour? Has the Israeli project been a success?
No, it's been turmoil, hasn't it? I've got a friend in Israel at the moment who says what a wonderful country it is, but it's fortress countries are not healthy. So I think I don't see that's going to be resolved in a peaceful way that gives people proper security. Proper security isn't barbed wire and tanks. Proper security is living peacefully with your neighbours.
Martin, 50 years since the Six-Day War, 100 years since Balfour.
Well, I think the government should have actually been even-handed, basically. That's what we've been looking for from them. And they haven't shown that.
Time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to our guests, former Mayor of Bristol, George Ferguson, also Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Join us after the news. We do our best to keep ahead of the curve.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.